Blog Talk Radio. Good evening, Pagans Tonight Radio listeners. You are listening to All Acts of Love and Pleasure here on Horns and Hump Day, Great Right Radio. I am Dr. Susan. I'm so glad to be with you this evening. I'm glad that you are making us part of your Wednesday evening. As always, I have my co-host here with me. At least theoretically, I have my co-host here with me. Let's see if I can bring him in.
We've had some tech. That's changed. It's still hot as hell. But, you know, it's going to be cool up there for a bit. Well, I won't keep you. Heck, I gotta run to the house. Mama says she...
We've been having some tech gremlins in the studio tonight. Let me try and bring Michael in again. I think I have Michael in the studio with me.
Hello.
It's been an interesting night already in the All Acts and Love and Pleasure studios. I guess I probably need to sage and maybe sprinkle some salt water around and see what's in the works, making everything crazy. But yes, you have joined us for All Acts of Love and Pleasure. We are the show where you get to hear us talk about sex, sexuality, relationships, and more, all from a pagan perspective. As always, I am Dr. Susan.
And I'm Michael Graywolf.
And we'd love if you would join us in the show tonight. You can be part of the show by hanging out in the chat room at pagantonight.com. You can also call in the U.S. at area code 347-308-8222. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/allactslove. You can join us on Twitter at Love and Pleasure. That's L-U-V and Pleasure. Or you can drop us an email at our Gmail account at xoflovandpleasure@gmail.com. So we would love for you to join in and be part of the discussion. We have a great guest tonight. We have Diana Rachel, who is author of Divorcing a Real Witch. She'll be joining us shortly. But how has your week been, Michael, or the 2 weeks since the last time we were on together?
Oh, it's been an interesting past couple of weeks. And I apologize if y'all heard, you know, a voice earlier while Dr. Susan was trying to introduce. I'm currently at home. I am in Dallas at the moment. And, you know, when you're away for a year and a half, people stop by unexpectedly.
Yes.
Oh, hi. One of my relatives popped into – I'm currently – doing the show from my backyard. So one of my relatives popped over the fence and was like, hey! I was like, hi! I didn't know what to say because I'm like, oh, my show's starting. Ah! But,
never a dull moment.
Yeah. But other than that, you know, it's going pretty well. I've been so busy just this week in general because, like I said, I'm on vacation back in Dallas, and I'm here with my partner, and we've just been hanging out with my family, doing a few things around town. We just went to the State Fair today, which was so much fun, and I was so excited to show my partner the State Fair because I'm always talking about it. You know, I'm one of the people in Dallas, in Texas, who loves the State Fair. You'll have people who are like, it's the State Fair. It's something that happens every year. Then you have the other people who are like, oh my God, it's a State Fair. I can't wait to go to it this year. That's me and my family.
The State Fair of Texas is very, very different than definitely the State Fair that I grew up with in South Dakota, which is fun, but is a fairly provincial affair. And the State Fair of Texas is its own thing.
Mm-hmm.
It is amazing. It's something I really think that people should see if they ever get the chance. So did you eat your weight in fried food?
Not as much as I would like to. I mean, I don't know if I could eat my weight in fried food anymore, just because I don't eat as much fried food as I used to. So, I mean, one of the first things I did when I got to the state fair was Butcher's Corny Dog. I mean, I was like, I have to have a corn dog.
Yes, you know, yes, because that is part of it.
And you know those packages of state fair corn dogs that they sell at the grocery store do not compare. And
no,
Have you been to the fair yet, Dr. Susan? Have you seen? Because Fletcher's now has some different corn dogs.
Oh, I haven't done that this year. No.
They have a, I think it's like a chicken or a turkey dog, and
mm-hmm.
a vegan one.
I heard that they were putting out a vegan one this year.
Well,
so
vegan
we might have to go.
Yeah. But I was like,
Stephanie,
oh my gosh, Jeff can have a corn dog. Yeah, Jeff can eat that. But, yeah, other than that, you know, we went out to the Gaberhood last night, had dinner with a friend. Of course, the Gaberhood was dead because it was a Tuesday night. But, you know, we're going to go this weekend and, you know, give Jeff a taste of what it's like on a weekend in Dallas.
Great. Too bad you're not here next weekend. You could go to the Halloween parade.
Yeah, I know. And that's also Jeff's birthday weekend.
That would have been
fun, but you know, the original plan for this week was to go to CMA Salon, which is going on right now. But we didn't end up going to that because of money, and you know, we've also been looking at a few apartments since we've been here.
Mm-hmm.
So,
which is always
just,
so fun.
Yeah. So, you know, we're trying to get a jump on getting ready to move back to Texas next year. So.
Awesome. I will be very excited for that.
What about you, Dr. Susan? What have you been up to the last couple of weeks?
Well, it's been busy. I went the weekend of October 7th, went to Festival of the Goddess, which is a women's gathering that happens in down near Austin. So that was lovely. I had to make a choice between that and CMA Salon. And when I kind of compared it, and then I knew you weren't going to be able to go to Salon, I chose Festival of the Goddess, and that was really good. I went with three of the folks from my New Moon Circle. So that was, we had beautiful weather, and the creek was high enough to go swimming and go splashing around in the waterfall. So that was just wonderful and renewing. The festival was dedicated to Isis, to sort of reclaiming her name. And Friday night, we did the opening ritual where we sort of bound the forces that would harm particularly women and other marginalized people. And, you know, like 2 hours later, all the information about the Trump tapes came out. So I'm not saying it's connected. I'm not saying it's not, but it was pretty powerful magic. And that's always just a lovely, lovely festival. People bring their daughters and their nieces, and there's a maiden's camp, and we build a big temple, and that was just wonderful. So I spent a couple of days out there, had my vending booth down there, and got to really connect with some people and with the you know, the earth, and you know, the weather starting to get cool. Finally, so it was good stuff. Then came back and had to deal with some kind of mundane things. My partner got into a car accident, which was not serious. She was not hurt, but it was enough to total out our car. So we spent most of last week kind of dealing with insurance, and then this last Monday, I went and bought a car. Which is the first time I've done that on my own ever. So she is going to get a nice settlement, and she'll replace her Honda. But we're going to be a two-car family for the first time in 3.5 years. So that was a lot of It's a lot of adulting. I'm the proud owner of a almost pristine 2004 Chevrolet Cavalier named Blanche. So there was a lot of that. And now just kind of getting ready for Samhain and planning what we're going to do. And it's about to get really busy here at work. So I had my women's full moon circle last Saturday night, which was wonderful. We had some new folks and some of the core. So that group continues to be a source of a lot of joy. And I've got the date for the next one.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think I remember seeing in your North Texas Nature Spirit group that you already had the date up for the November circle.
I do. It'll be November 12th. And I'll put that announcement on our Facebook page for any women, cis women or trans women or non-binary folks who find their spiritual homes in spaces that are either women-centered or femme-centric. Really, really cool. We're getting a wide variety of people, and we're at Horizon Unitarian Universalist Church in Carrollton, and we are just loving that space. We'll be using the labyrinth either in November or December as part of our circle, because there's one there on site. So maybe while you're in town, can take you out there and show you the space we're using. So it's been a busy couple of weeks. I've been trying to do some writing and get some things kind of squared away before work gets busy, because we're already heading down towards deadline, which seems very strange. People are getting ready to graduate in December, so it's a busy time. It's good. I'm looking forward to spending some time with you while you're here. I know you're running around everywhere, but catch up with you Friday night.
Yes.
That'll be good. Trying to launch our chat room, but it's being persnickety. We were just having all kinds of tech stuff tonight.
You know, stuff happens.
Yeah, we just roll with it. We roll with it. Well, we have an absolutely fabulous guest this evening. We have author Diana Rachel with us. She is the author of the Diagram Prize nominated book Divorcing a Real Witch for Pagans and the People Who Used to Love Them, which I just finished and is a great book. I wish I had had it when I went through my own divorce, and I will be definitely recommending it to people I know that are going through that experience and to people who work with people that are going through that experience. She also wrote the Mabon and Samhain installments of the most recent version of the Llewellyn Sabbat Essential Series. Those are great books if you haven't checked them out. And you can find out more at her website, which is DianaRachel.com, and that's RAJCHEL.com. We are so glad that she kind of bore with us through all the tech problems. And welcome to the show, Diana.
Hi, thank you. And yeah, I kind of wish I had that book too. It's why I wrote it.
I was going to ask you.
Yeah, and before people get too impressed with the Diagram Prize, that is a prize for the book with the strangest title. It was beat up by a book titled Strangers Have the Best Candy, but it was really close.
Ooh, that is a great title, though.
Yeah, and there was actually some argument about the title because the Moon Books is a British publisher, and in the UK, apparently the pagan conversation is about, well, who is a real witch? Is it the Wiccan? Is it the, you know, countryside hedge witch, traditionalist, whatever? And apparently they get very much up in arms about it. So to some people there, it seemed almost like a personal attack. Well, over here, it seems like it bordered on misogynist metaphor.
Can't win.
You know, I've learned to see society as either people I can work with to make something new, or people that are there for me to mess with.
Yes.
And it's very true in a pagan level, too. And, you know, there's a reason that the Fool is the beginning of the tarot.
Mm-hmm.
Everything starts with somebody getting messed with a little bit.
Yes. Well, and, you know, one of the things that sort of I find helped me survive my divorce was a sense of humor. And sometimes that takes the form of gallows humor, and you just got to go with it. Otherwise you'll do nothing but cry, right?
Oh, absolutely. And especially since it's one of those liminal areas where it's the same amount of grief as death. It does trigger the same somatic cues. It's a lot of, I had all of these plans and now they're gone, which is what happens when someone dies. And I'm really feeling this right now. My best friend died in February. So it's kind of, you know, reviewing the parallel of what that experience can be like. And I'm also dealing with my wife's recent transition. So, you know, whole new layers to all of this for me right now.
Whoa.
And yeah. Yeah. Life just keeps handing stuff to me. You know, apparently it's saying, you're not doing enough. I'm going to put you through this now, but yeah.
Which means there's another book in there somewhere.
Yeah, my agent keeps telling me that, and I think I can't even imagine. It took me 10 years to write Divorcing a Real Witch because it took me that long to get enough distance. I can't even imagine how much distance I would need. I mean, I'm trying to convince my wife I need a place to write in Hawaii, but she's not buying it.
Ooh. Keep trying.
Eventually, I will get there. I'm working on a book that has nothing to do with the emotional stuff for my next one. And I kind of consider the Mabin and Samhain ones part of the emotional work because those are the most emotionally involved parts of the Sabbat cycle because they're about grief and death and loss and resurrection. Mm-hmm. And
absolutely.
So, and divorce is just one of those aspects. So, you know, I'm a big proponent of the artist's way. And I've worked through almost everything Julia Cameron's ever written about creativity and gone through the exercises and programs. And there was one called Vein of Gold that I was working through right after my father died. And I realized that I am strangely good at dealing with things involving grief. So, you know, I don't want to be like Daria Morgendorfer, the bummer witch, but this is the thing I seem to be good at doing.
Well, and there's been, you know, a real dearth of resources for those kinds of things in our community, at least, you know, here in the U.S. I know I was talking to a friend of mine today that's going to CMA Samhain, the festival that Michael mentioned, and Maka Nightmare is the special guest there. And a friend of mine was like, well, who is she? And after I got done kind of like, how do you not know? I was mentioning that she had worked with Starhawk on the Pagan Book of Living and Dying. And when that book came out, you know, they both said it, basically people in our community started to die and we didn't know what to do. And so we had to create this book. We were a community, a movement that was mostly young people, but people age and people die and people get sick. And there was no guidebook. And I feel a little bit, you know, like Divorcing a Real Witch fills that guide too. There's so many books on hand fastings and on marriage, but there's nothing about this other side.
And death and divorce are two things people really don't want to think about. So it's one of the reasons why there's so much need and so much dearth. And there is still nothing for pagan funeral planning. And in most funeral homes, all the default stuff goes to the Christianity stuff. Unless you're part of a specific culture that's going to have a specific type of funeral home. And divorce fault isn't quite as extreme in that manner. It's more difficult for parents, especially if they are two different religions or if one of the parents converts after or right before the divorce. And, you know, so then there's that added family complication, especially since it's, I would dare to say in this period of time we're going through, it's not as bad as it used to be, which is like saying you're not, that house is not on as much fire as it used to be. But, you know, people aren't necessarily losing their kids over being pagan. Judges aren't automatically assuming they're bathing in goat's blood. You know, it's a little better, but, you know, it's such a delicate balance because everything has gotten so excessively polarized that reason isn't even a way to get through to people anymore. And this is in places where it's the law, where reason really should be what's coming first, and that is so not how they're operating. And
I hear you.
Yeah, and so there's this big hole, and not just in pagan culture, but in overculture, where people just don't want to deal with this stuff, yet it's so unavoidable. I'm I don't know if either one of you saw, there was a viral tweet commented about, you know, something to the effect of course I need my friends. If I get sick without them, I'm going to die because no one will be able to fundraise for me.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
some of that financial and economic impact really affects divorce as well. It's actually one of the reasons that it can become so excessively gender polarizing even now.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And then there's the added aspect that with SCOTUS passed, there were several gay couples who really wanted a divorce who couldn't get one because they legally didn't have the right to a divorce.
Right. Right. And that was actually one of the cases here in Texas was, you know, part of that whole parcel and package that went to SCOTUS. It's like, this isn't that's so much about marriage rights as about the right to not to get unmarried. And I think people forget
right.
that that's a piece of it.
Right. And I know a lot of people think that, well, and this is something I mentioned the book, and I mean, it's been a while since I've read my own book because it's like, I don't know, it's like looking at selfies, I get really uncomfortable after a while. But I do think I remember mentioning something about, there's a lot of people who think of divorce as this social problem that needs to be prevented. And mm-hmm. I don't see that as a social problem. Divorce was created as a very necessary social solution. And it was a social solution not to unhappy marriages, but to murder. And
mm-hmm.
once you take that into account, I mean, you know, Alabama tried to outlaw divorce as soon as they gave up and re-legalized it. Their murder rate dropped by almost 150%.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, people don't understand that that's the way, especially for women that are married to men. The way that a lot of us get out of our marriage is feet first. And
yeah.
we have to have these other ways of doing it.
Yeah. Well, especially since part of the problem is that domestic violence was completely normalized right up until about 1980.
Right.
So there's a lot of stuff that people just thought was part and parcel of a marriage that was actually pretty unhealthy. And the attitude that a man had the right to discipline his wife the same as his children, because apparently when America formed as a democracy, they were going a little too far into ancient Greece.
I think I've done a little bit of work, and I want to do some writing about domestic violence in the pagan community, cause as somebody who, you know, is a domestic violence survivor, and my abuser was somebody in my community with me, and you know, who had some, you know, fairly heinous verbal abuse committed towards me in like pagan festival settings, and like security never came and helped. Nobody ever did anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that we need to talk about those things too. But again, it's all that sort of dark side nobody wants to talk about.
Yeah. Well, and there's always the issue of people. There is a lot of criticism of people for not intervening when they see violence in front of them.
Uh-huh.
And here's the problem is one, the violence could very well turn on them, or other people
right.
trying to intervene could intervene on them trying to interfere with what's happening. And I've seen this happen
absolutely.
A few times.
It's so hard.
And
absolutely.
I've worked as a battered women's advocate, and I've been in abusive relationships myself. Not the ex-husband that I write about in that book. I mean, he was manipulative, but that was, you know, it wasn't anything as heinous as some stuff I dealt with in relationships before, which, you know, looking back, this is before I understood that emotional violence has a physical impact and needs to be
right.
treated the same as physical violence. So, you know, some of my awareness of how bad things were, and I think this happens to most people, comes far, far after the fact as you start to realize, oh, hey, that's really real.
Absolutely.
Especially
mm-hmm.
when the violence
absolutely.
Is delivered in a form that looks like an abstraction, and people are only starting to understand that words have physical effects. You know, I'm a bit of a hobbyist. This is actually part of my kink community, is playing around with hypnosis and NLP. And, you know, NLP is one of those tools that can be used for great good or great evil, because you can use words to rewire somebody's brain. It's one of the reasons cognitive behavioral therapy is so very effective.
And one of the reasons gaslighting is so effective.
Yes, and nasty and common and done on such a cultural level that it's still invisible to people, that until either it's done to them or until something makes them wake up and realize, oh, hey, I'm doing this. And, you know, and then it comes back down to that ugly little thing of denial where some people either will realize they've done these things and don't want to take into account who that means they are. Since,
right.
most, you know, I would say most people, until they hit like some kind of life crisis event, are generally living to live up to some projected image they have of themselves.
Totally.
So rather,
totally.
You know, rather than authentic being. And this is where a lot of that crap comes from. And that image, once you understand where the image comes from, if it's pulled from your parents and their marriage, or if it's pulled from the people around you, I know that the community I grew up in was very emotionally violent as well. You know, and of course, since I had a non-standard issue body and a semi non-standard issue ethnicity, that was also a problem. And so it was basically the series of projections and tearing them apart to get to the authentic person is kind of a radical act of just, even if it's just going, oh, hey, that was wrong. I'm not going to do that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, you get at a lot of like really key stuff in this book beyond just sort of like the mechanics of divorce and rituals of, you know, for hand parting, but, you know, talk about things like, you know, how do things square with like the Wiccan read and harm, and how do you do self-reflection?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the section where you talk about, you know, coping with a marriage that's ending because of oath breaking and what happens if you're the one that broke the oath, you know,
yeah.
I think there are a lot of, some really amazing tools in this book beyond just sort of like, okay, here's the magical component of, you know, undoing the hand fasting. Like there's a lot of stuff that I think people outside of a Wiccan or pagan tradition, but, you know, could take from this book, because it does get into these issues about, you know, what did you learn about marriage in your family home, or what have you taken in from the culture, and that all of that impacts the way that we do marriage, no matter what our religious path is.
Yeah. Yeah. I know part of that was that I interviewed close to 200 people, either through an intensive survey or face to face, about their divorces and how they got there, and as much as I could about what their expectations were before they went in, as opposed to what happened on their way out. And it really helped me realize all areas to cover. Last year I taught a workshop related to this book at PantheaCon, and I had a really interesting moment where there was someone who had been cheated on and someone who had cheated that were both there dealing with the different aspects of the emotional fallout. Now,
Whoa.
Thank God it was for the same couple, but they were able to have a really good dialogue with each other almost as proxies for the other people affected by their behavior. And,
oh, that's powerful.
It was very powerful. It's informed my choices a lot. And, you know, at the time of my divorce, I was monogamous. I'm in a polyamorous marriage now. And one of the things I'm running into now is, though, you know, there's a lot of people with a very strong millennial feminist view that nobody owes anybody anything. And I just cannot buy into that. So, like, my wife has been really, really great about picking really great metamors. Like, they're all wonderful people. They're really good about respecting boundaries. We treat each other with respect. My boyfriend is he's younger, so he's still figuring that stuff out. And I've been running into I'm your metamor, so I owe you nothing mentality that gets projected on people that cheat in monogamous marriages. And, it's, you know, it's not an okay attitude. I just cannot buy into that. You know, I hold myself responsible for, you know, at least making sure I get my health screened and, you know, basically saying hello and just respecting boundaries and schedules, you know, which, you know, when there's multiple people around, that seems to be reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
but there's this overarching attitude that's growing, and it may just be a West Coast thing, I don't know, that nobody owes anybody anything. And that doesn't seem to bode well for the future of a lot of partnerships.
No, no, it doesn't. And I mean, you definitely, you know, crossing into areas of polyamory and other consensual non-monogamy, like that adds a whole other piece, but that's something that is so common in our community. You know, we're just now getting resources around that too. So it feels like, you know, we're kind of like as a movement, we're all starting to grow up.
Yeah.
And realizing we got to do this adult stuff.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, and one of the reasons I'm bringing this up is that one of the aspects that I do feel where the book was weak that needs more work, that I'm hoping someone will pick up who's more experienced with this than I am, is that there was the question of people that, and there were several people that answered the survey that were in polyamorous relationships where they were divorcing one partner. And something I noticed was that the people that were polyamorous did a better job of making sure they had some time for rest and reflection before committing to another relationship. It was the people that identified as monogamous that were spending some time, I think, like either there was like overlap of a minimum of 2 months where one relationship started before the divorce was even filed for. And others where it was usually, I think the longest somebody waited was 6 months. And, you know, I understand, you know, human hunger, skin touch, that's a need. But it's kind of concerned me that so many people have this, you know, they have this idea that their community has to start with being partnered, and it becomes this unnecessary fear of being alone. You know, and part
for
of
sure.
it is divorce has that stigma, and people withdraw from their communities when they're dealing with a marriage that's falling apart. And a lot of people will look at the stuff and go, oh, that's drama. I want nothing to do with it. And, you know, again, it's like what you said, Dr. Susan, it's the we're all starting to grow up is understanding that, you know, everybody's got drama. It's how much of a show they make out of it that really is what matters.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, you know, and there are people who aren't, you know, going through tough things that aren't making a big show out of it. You know, and that's a pretty mature thing is going, hey, I'm dealing with this. Or, you know, they don't have to tell the whole story, but going, hey, you know, I'm up for this much contact, but this is taking my energy, you know, but right now we have to treat it like a big dramatic secret when we're going through it. And this is another area where people are denied support when they need their community the most. At the same time, pagans still have divorce stigma, even though I would say it's super, super common. But there is still a lot of stigma. And I know at the time I went through my divorce, I was about 26, so really young, like really young to be divorced, partly because there was a lot of cultural pressure on me to get married even earlier than the time that I did. Like my mother was worried that my eggs were going to just dry up and run off and join the circus because that was her mentality. And, you know, looking back, one is that people are still making decisions based on outdated ideas about fertility and how long we really have. And as we are inchingly getting more information about women's health and, you know, ways to conceive that may be at better times in our lives, it's becoming less important to get married that young just to make babies. On top of it, I really don't think that if you want to have children, marriage is necessarily something you should make a requirement to. You know, there are people who can successfully co-parent without having to have that legal commitment. Although I do understand insurance is a big freaking deal.
Yeah. What would you say has been the overall, the overall reception that your book has received from the public, from media?
Surprisingly positive. I mean, granted, I mean, I think I've sold less than 500 copies or even less than 100 maybe at this point. But from those that have pirated it liberally, and yes, I know you're out there. I hope you got something out of it at least. It does seem to be really well received. It's covering, it surprises people. I know, like, there's one of, like, the total of 4 Amazon reviews I have right now where someone had bought it just out of curiosity after seeing it listed on the Diagram Prize nominees and wrote something about, I was really surprised by this book. It's something you don't really think about, but it's out there, and it was kind of useful for me too, even though I don't identify as pagan at all. So I would say it's very positive. I think that, like, I know it used to be Pangaea and, like, the permutations of the Blessed Bee magazines. So I think it was in New Witch, I think is what it's called now. Someone, I can't remember the writer, but it was someone who was very concerned that it would just be, here's a bunch of rituals and I hope you feel better and try to be, let's all try to be friends, which if you've been through a divorce, you know why that is just not realistic. Even if you like each other and you like each other again, you still need to hate each other for a little while. It's just easier. But she was also pretty happy because I did talk about domestic abuse and oath breaking and dealing with that. And I know the two valid criticisms I've gotten, and I haven't gotten that many, was that I need to talk more about how I went about my survey because it wasn't academic. You know, I did have a few people that were just plain squirrely. Like, one person asked what their spiritual identification was. It was very clearly labeled, this is a survey for people that are pagan that have gone through divorce, and they wrote, none of your business. So it's hard to control that kind of stuff. People are squirrely.
Yes.
It's a thing with the pagan community. And when I was soliciting surveys, I did get treated with a lot of suspicion and hostility because, you know, I'm not a big name. There are people you can reference for me, but, you know, unless you've got that whole big name pagan thing going on, people tend to be very wary of you. And
I did my dissertation with the pagan community here in Texas, and it absolutely helped that I could produce a letter from a university saying that I was legit and that I had to, you know, that we had to do consent and all that stuff. Cause you know, people are definitely suspicious. So,
yeah. And I understand why they want to protect themselves, but the reasons are sometimes a little skewed. Not always, but sometimes. And I mean, self-protection is good. It's just that it's like the problem you had with your abuser in the community is they're protecting the wrong things a lot of the time. So that was the one, is that the data was a little weak. The other one is, because I'm not a parent, at least not in the traditional sense, I didn't really cover a lot about children. It's also because there are scads of books and research done on the impact of divorce on children already that aren't necessarily pagan geared, but are still valuable to pagan parents. And personally, I would rather they go with psychology and science over spirituality with that, because my spiritual opinions about children, how children should be raised, are not nearly as relevant as well-backed up data about what is actually working well for them depending on what their neural type is.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just the basic logistics of, you know, respectful co-parenting and, you know, things, you know, if you're working with, you know, young children, what's the importance of, you know, keeping routines the same between the parents' homes and all that transcends theology.
Yeah. Well, and what I will say is I took a course on divorce and children for a psychology elective, like way back before I ever knew I was going to write this book. And it was pretty clear that how much children were affected by divorce relied entirely on the behavior of their parents. And I don't think that's changed. I've also noticed, and this is partly because my boyfriend's parents have been married for 30 years and they're going through a divorce right now, is that divorce tends to have a worse impact on older children and adult children than it does on younger children. And it may just be come down to what they think of as normal. But I've noticed, you know, and this is purely anecdotal. I haven't done any research on this or done any interviews. It's just when I've noticed with my friends in my life, especially if it's the nuclear parents or the ones that they started with, when the parents get divorced after the kids are adults, it does tend to have a worse impact on them. And I imagine it's something that they're getting old enough, they're starting to get these ideas about continuity, maybe thinking subconsciously about end of life and what they want middle of life to look like. And then, boom, their parents go ahead and just break the model that they've been working off of.
Right. It makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, meanwhile, the parents were probably waiting each other out until the kids moved out to do this.
Right, because there is that, and they even bring it up in the book that especially for women, especially for women who are married to men, especially for cis women who are married to cis men, that there's this expectation that you'll stay married until your children are out of the house. You know, people do that whole staying together for the kids thing, even though, you know, the research sounds like it really bears out that that has a worse effect a lot of the time.
Yeah. So one of the more valuable things I've gotten from the very few Twitter trolls I've gotten over this, and I'm lucky, is that I don't get trolled very often. I think I'm just not very much fun because I post links about the psychology of trolls and they always get annoyed and go away when I do that. But they really hate it when I call them out. I don't know why that is.
I want to see that. That's a great strategy.
No, but there is, especially from like the men's rights activists and the Mennonists and, you know, the people that are probably never, ever going to have a cis woman who's willing to be in a room with them ever. But one of the attitudes they hold up is this idea that women get married and then divorce people for the money. And I mean, the Center for Disease Control is the site that the government agency that tracks the most details about divorce, and it does track the economic impact. And it's still pretty clearly across any demographic is that women always, almost always, suffer economically from a divorce. You know, it's always worse for the women than men. The men end up financially better off, especially since there's still relatively little enforcement over child support and almost no enforcement over alimony. And consequently, they can just kind of take off, and unless the woman has the means to go get the guy, or, you know, he married a witch and she's going to find a way to go get him, there's usually not a lot of follow-through there, and there's very little enforcement over it at all. And it's getting better. The deadbeat dad laws have done a lot for kids, but there isn't anything like that for spousal support.
Right.
A lot of people think of it as it's a linear, oh, well, you can't depend on him, go get a job. But then, you know, you're dealing with one is that it's basically only straight-sized women. You know, most jobs only want to hire straight-sized women, or they will pay plus-size women less. And if you have kids, your body's going to change. there's the reality that, you know, these women took like 10 years out of their career. They're not going to be even making close to what they would have made if they hadn't taken that time out. Whereas men can usually negotiate to an equivalent position of where they would have been if they had taken time out. You know, it's kind of a morass there.
And there's research as Ann Crittenden, I think, researched, you know, how much when women in particular, because is most often women in especially a household where you have a male parent and a female parent that take time out of the paid workforce to raise children full time, you also lose all that Social Security, all that everything that you would have been earning had you been working. And so that it has all these long term effects if you end up, you know, divorced or widowed. It can have these long, far reaching impacts on your life, and there's not always redress for it. There are places you can't even sort of sue for spousal support. So it's wrapped up with all this other stuff. It's more than just what happens between the two people in a relationship.
Yeah, I know. My first thought is that, especially with the idea about women just getting divorced to be gold diggers, which is so ridiculous, is one, it goes back to the old school thing where our careers were basically nun, nurse, teacher, or wife. Or even before that, when, you know, nurse and teacher weren't even on that list, and where literally finding a husband was finding your living. It's also, it's also that Michael Moore pointed out is that most Americans think of themselves as temporarily embarrassed millionaires. Well, the truth is the vast majority of us are not that freaking special. We're not going to suddenly magically be rich. And that means that in terms of doing the marriage thing, you know, we're not going to be the Ivankas of the world in finding a billionaire because there just aren't that many. And honestly,
absolutely,
they kind of tend to be a close, highly inbred group for a reason, because they're very protective of that money. Ain't nobody else getting in.
No.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's the reality of, you know, dude, we know you don't have the money and we don't want it anyway, or you, but when people have those particular attitudes about women and money and divorce. Go on.
And I really like that you pointed out and you brought it up too, you know, how prevalent divorce stigma is. And you bring up the idea in the book of divorce contagion.
Yes.
About how, you know, people fear, because I know I certainly experienced it, because I, you know, I got divorced in my early 30s, and several of my friends, you know, waited until their late 20s or early 30s to get married, although they had been with their partners for a long time. And so I was basically getting divorced in the middle of this whole clutch of relative newlyweds, and absolutely experienced that like people are like, over there, you know, don't get any of your divorce germs on us. And I think that was interesting. You pointed out this one that absolutely exists in the pagan community. And I was wondering how you sort of see that play out within the pagan community.
So one of the awkward things for me was, because of my age, I was being talked down to by people both older and younger than me because of my divorce. So, you know, I also had to move from a fairly rural area where I basically was the linchpin for the pagan community to one where the pagan community had been running on its own for a while. And so, you know, the people that were closer to my age were part of a university group, so I'd be hanging out with them. And then I would try to go to some of the larger things in the Twin Cities, because I was living in Minneapolis for the last 13 years. And then I moved to San Francisco about 2 years ago, where it's even an even different story from that. But what I was finding was that, one is that a lot of the older people are like, oh yeah, I've been through it, I know how that feels, except that most of them had been through divorce when they were older. And so, and their attitudes were colored by cultural expectations that were specific to that particular decade that were things I experienced, but in entirely different ways. And what was happening with the people that were my age and a little bit younger is, oh, you must be a failure at relationships because that marriage failed.
Mm-hmm.
So,
oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Although I will give great credit to the best man at my wedding to my second partner, is he commented that he was just fine with me being a divorcee because at least I knew how to get out of a bad relationship.
Nice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, which was astoundingly supportive, especially since he really was never sure what to do with me. But it was, there was this attitude where it got to the point where if I was in dating sites, and I realized part of it was an inner transition as well, is the, if I marked that I was divorced, I had too much baggage. If I marked that I was single, then I was approachable. And there was this idea, you know, it was the projection of the bitter divorcee. Even if I wasn't particularly bitter, I was sad, certainly. And I was definitely conflicted, because it took me a good 2 years after filing to really, truly extricate myself from my ex-husband. And, of course, there was very little support for dealing with that and dealing with those holdover feelings, and still a lot of shame around sexuality, even while people were pushing me to be more sexual and more high-risk sexual than I was really comfortable with. And so
definitely,
it was like, yeah, all of the cognitive dissonance all at once, basically in both ears very loudly. Yeah. And, of course, my family was not supportive on a good day and even less about this. So I didn't really, you know, I was basically living on a city on my own. A lot of my friends had withdrawn from me. And Minnesota is a super, for, especially given that it's in the U.S., it is an unbelievably high-context culture, which means that it is very, it makes it very difficult to make friends. And sometimes there are people that I've been at least on first name basis with for more than 5 years, you probably still wouldn't really consider me part of their friendship circle.
Uh-huh.
You know,
uh-huh.
You know, I did make friends over time, but there was, again, that added cultural barrier on top of it. And so there's a lot of Viking survival mentality of I was an outside tribe member and I did not come with sufficient support. So,
yeah, I'm from that part
like,
of the country, and I understand completely what you're saying.
Oh, you know what I mean. Yeah. Yeah, Minnesota nice is basically, yeah. And since I have no other way of communicating besides direct, I have a very good friend who is native Minnesotan, who's a little bit of an outlier, and so she will help me translate things into Minnesota nice so I can actually get the result that I wanted to in the first place. Because
yeah,
nothing
I had
is more
to learn.
Offensive than oh, yeah. Yeah.
I had
nothing
to learn the equivalent when I moved to the South. So I had to learn how to properly use the phrase, bless your heart.
So, oh, God. I've learned to cut and run whenever I hear that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm in California now. So, I mean, it's very, very different, much more open culture in California, a little uncomfortably open for me at times now, especially out in San Francisco area. So I had one friend who was telling me, because he had to do some tax consultancy with people in Minneapolis and in San Francisco. And in people in Minneapolis, he'd say, can I see your tax record? And they'd say, why do you need to see that? He'd go to San Francisco and say, I need to see your tax records. And they'd say, let me tell you about my divorce. I totally believe it.
Oh, I love that. Well, and I think that, you know, one of the things that's so I just totally lost my train of thought there. But that hang on, it's back up to the station. Here it is. That, you know, within a pagan context, you know, one of the things that I sort of ran into when I was going through my divorce is there were people that were kind of like, well, but I mean, like, we don't have, like, we're cool with non-monogamy here. Like, I mean, do you have to get divorced? Couldn't you just, like, open your marriage? Could you do something else? And it was sort of this very strange, like,
what?
Whoa, hang on. Like, oh, we didn't think, yeah, it was very strange. And in sort of my research for my dissertation, because I researched around sort of gender and things, I talked to a number of people that sort of, like, had stayed in very unhappy marriages for a long time and had sort of consensual other partners on the side because they sort of didn't want to deal with all the BS that goes around getting divorced. And
mm-hmm.
So there's this like weird conflation with, you know, as a community
yeah.
that's friendly to alternative relationship structures. I don't know if you ran into that at all, but that was something that, that I ran into more than once in my own research, and it made me really sad.
Not as much, but then there wasn't infidelity involved with the end of my first marriage at all. Uh-huh. And so I'm polyamorous now, but there's never been infidelity because, I mean, my wife thinks I'm demisexual. I think I'm just picky. But, you know, there's not like a heavy acquisition of partners to begin with. But
right.
I did notice that some poly people were a little overeager to bring me into the tribe without really checking where I was at with that. But
yeah.
Just the idea of seeing it as a solution to something where two people are miserable with each other is, I'm sorry, that's insane. Just no, don't do that. If you don't like each other,
yep.
just move the hell out. Finding other partners, that's all on you. That's probably okay, but just don't live with each other. I will say that there have been situations I've known of where they do have to stay together for the health insurance, which sucks, but stuff happens
oh, I know.
That way. Yeah, and I know of at least one case where it just turned into this weird power standoff because in Indiana and in Minnesota, both parties have to sign the divorce decree. Otherwise, it can cost up to tens of thousands of dollars to get, like, a one-sided divorce.
Whoa,
because
oh, they don't have no home,
yeah.
do they?
Yeah, like, you have to, you know, you have to both get signatures. And I had a problem with my ex-husband with that is, I went and I presented him with the papers and said, you know, with the dissolution papers and told him, you know, this really isn't working. You know, we try to change and it always goes right back to the same old thing. And he's like, okay, fine. Sat down with me, signed it. And then the next morning he came in smelling of wood smoke. And I realized later that he'd gone out and burned those papers.
Wow.
Yeah. And then his comment a few months later is that really wasn't good for a relationship, was it? So,
oh my goodness.
It's funny now. At the time, it was really not funny. At the time, it was just scary.
No kidding.
And he did, yeah. And, you know, at the time, I mean, yeah, socially, he was a little in some ways. I'm not really sure what happened to him when he was a kid, but there was just chunks missing. And it's just one of those where I've realized that, you know, I've had moments of guilt about that, but, and there's always guilt with divorce, which nobody talks about either, is they look at the bitter and the angry and all of the stuff, and they don't really look at the personal guilt, especially when you're the one that leaves.
Yep, absolutely.
And, you know, and especially when you're the woman that leaves, there's always extra guilt because you failed at being the wife in terms of the entity.
Totally. And you kind of, if you're the one that leaves, you are sort of not given permission to grieve and be sad. Because if you were going to grieve and be sad, why did you leave? Yeah.
Right. You should be happy. And I had that problem. Yeah, I had that problem, especially with the women I was hanging around with. And, I mean, as a sideline, it taught me a lot about toxic female friendships. And that's something else that we haven't addressed yet in culture too well. Mean Girls is a good start, but we have a long way to go. And there was
I've been doing a little writing on that.
I've actually been thinking. I teach. I'm trying to put together Artist Way classes, but I've been working out at a shop in Walnut Creek called the Mystic Dream and reading there. And most of my clients are women that are dealing with toxic woman friendship issues, or toxified women's identity. And I really feel like I need to run a women's detox program. You know,
I'm actually in the midst of putting together a retreat about confronting internalized misogyny as a way to start dealing with some of that myself. So I totally am right there with you.
Yeah. Well, on the second side, letting me want to pursue, and something that's definitely informing anything I'm putting together on this, is that narcissistic personality disorder in women tends to get ignored, and it has a huge impact on especially adult children.
Absolutely.
And so it goes beyond internalized misogyny to almost this gamification of human behavior. And, you know, it's like male sociopaths have different methods than female sociopaths, and it falls along the same line. And, you know, and misogyny is definitely part of it, but it's also, you know, a narcissist doesn't have any particular feelings about anything except themselves. It's just a tool that they are able to recognize somehow and use on the people they're trying to get their narcissistic supply off of.
Right, absolutely. And that's, you know, that's a whole other thing, especially in faith communities where you have charismatic leaders. Like, you know, what we see is sort of powerful personalities, and what is toxic, that line often blurs so hard.
Yes. Yeah, and what's toxic in one moment can be funny in another moment, depending on the context and how well you trust that person.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
An hour goes so fast. Like, this has been so much fun. But tell us a little bit about what are you working on now? You said it doesn't have anything to do with the dark, deep side of human nature.
Yeah. In some ways it might be, but depending on how far I dig, but I'm on contract with Llewellyn for a book on urban magic. And
this one isn't
going to be there. Yeah. If you've read like the City Spirit, I can't remember what Christopher Penzack's book was called. And there was another one, I think by Raven Caldera, called Urban Primitive years ago. And this isn't what you do because you're stuck living in a city. It's let's look at how architecture affects human behavior. You know, how can you leverage that for magic working? You know, what kind of magic can you do? Sometimes borrowing from ancient Rome, where, you know, absolutely everything was religious and civic at the same time, and bringing that spirit into community connection now. And working with City Spirit and Land Spirit, and like having those personalities, because city spirits do want to stay in human events because they're, you know, their very personalities are affected by the human events. So, you know, San Francisco is slowly turning into a douchey hipster when it really just wants to be a crazy hippie. And so working with the magic of that to find that healthy baseline. And
absolutely.
Yeah. And it's not just a poor you, you live in the city. It's a, hey, look, nature's right here. You just need to look. And finding ways to connect with that. Because, I mean, ultimately, Wicca, when it first came to the United States, was initially an urban religion and became paganized as Oberon Zillah's influence spread. But, and a lot of witchcraft, old school and new school, was actually, like, even in ancient Sumer, very city-centered. There isn't a conflict with being in an urban environment and practicing magic. And there's really some really cool things you can do with it. Beyond playing Pokemon Go, which isn't bad.
Which isn't bad. Well, we will look forward to reading that when it comes out. I'm going to keep an eye on your website to know when that comes out. I'm getting the bing in my ear that our time is up. So I'm going to give many, many thanks to Diana Rachel for coming on to talk about her book. It is Divorcing a Real Witch for Pagans and the People Who Used to Love Them, which is available through Amazon.com. You can get it for your Kindle. It's published by Moon Books. We'd love to have you back on sometime, Diana.
I would really enjoy that.
All right. Pam is not on this week. She is working hard on the presidential campaign, and she says Hillary owns her until November 8th. But she will be back next week with a replay of her episode with Christy Robinette about Christy's book about Poe as her spirit guide. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with Lasara Firefox Allen talking about Jailbreaking the Goddess, which is an amazing book. And next week, Jason will be here with Raise the Horns Radio. So until then, I am Dr. Susan.
And I'm Michael Graywolf.
And we have been sharing all acts of love and pleasure with you. Bright blessings and have a wonderful evening. All right. Thank you both so much.
Thank you. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
That was a lot of fun. We'd love to have you back.
I would enjoy that a great deal.
Especially when you write that next book on
Yeah, I mean,
personality disorder.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that might just be like an autobiography of a scapegoat or something, but yeah.
I didn't realize you did work with the Mystic Dream. So you work with Devin Hunter and Storm Fairy Wolf?
Yeah, Devin's the one who hired me when he realized he was going to be writing a lot and needed another psychic in the shop.
Ha! Huh. Awesome. I don't know them personally. I follow them online, and they're actually friends with a lot of my brothers and them named Pat.
Yeah, they're really good people. They are very good people. So I've really been enjoying working for them. And I know they're like all three of the, because it's Storm and his husband Chaz, and then Devin.
Yeah.
All three of them are writing books right now. And so there's been a lot of chaos in the shop because especially Chaz, who's the actual shop owner, is so introverted, putting words to the written page is hard for him. Yes, it's really sweet. But I think it's really cool because all three of them have books coming out. And so I know that's going to be a big deal pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's wonderful. It makes me both inspired and intimidated to get off my butt and actually get back to some of the writing that I've let languish.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean,
quite
every
a while,
day.
Interviewing authors.
Yeah, well, and lately my battle is between the laundry and the manuscript because one gets in the way of the other all the time.
It's funny how that happens. And I'm a fan of the Artist's Way and Julia Cameron's work as well, so I've been thinking it's time for me to break out my Artist's Way again and crank it back up because my habits kind of languish. It's time to get back to that.
Yeah, I'm very seriously thinking about starting some kind of online pagan-directed version just because it is easier to stick to it when there is a cluster, especially because sometimes you just need somebody there to say, stop hitting yourself.
Yes. It hurts when I keep hitting my head with this hammer.
Pretty much,
but it'll
feel
so good when you stop.
you know, or do, yeah, well, and I mean, the worst thing about morning pages is you actually see what you're actually thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's like, I don't want to be that person, but it's in your head. And you have to remind yourself that by getting it on the paper, it's no longer in your head. You're not carrying that with you. It's the paper's problem now.
Right? Yeah, make room for more. No, I would love to be kept up on that if you're when you get that started, because I would jump all over that.
Oh, yeah. I do have a mailing list on my website, and I mean, there's like three Diana Rachels in the world, and I'm the one that's, you know, I'm not the hot Polish blonde. I'm the curvy brunette Polish lady, so.
Gotcha. Okay.
Super easy to find.
Awesome. Yeah, I've got your link, so yeah, I'll get in there and sign up, and you know, watch what you're doing with great interest. Because it's such an important book. It fills just a void that was there. So it's kind of a, you know, Moon Books asked me if I wanted a review copy, and I'm like, yes, please. So I'm glad we were able to get you on, even with all the tech glitches tonight.
Yeah. Yeah, it happens. There's one time when I was doing a show with Taylor Elwood where the entire system crashed, like all of Blog Talk.
Oh, no.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
We were both pretty frustrated. Like, we were getting really on a really good tangent, and all of a sudden, boom, the entire network went down for the next 48 hours.
Oh, no. Oh. I am getting a text that my spouse is here to pick me up, so I am going to sign off, and thank you both so much.
Yes.
Okay, and have a good night. It was wonderful meeting both of you.
Absolutely.
You
it was
too.
Lovely. All right, and
all right,
I will
night.
Talk to you either later tonight or tomorrow, Michael, so we can get together while you're here in town.
Yes. All right.
All right. Yep. So have a great
all
night.
Right. Bye. You too.
Bye.